From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Congressman Seth Moulton on getting more people into the tech pipeline.
This should be something that not only benefits American workers, but benefits American companies, especially the startups, the new companies that are leading the way in technology.
Also today, as the Senate continues to debate its health care bill, we speak with Alicia and Will Etheridge of Maine about how Medicaid helps save their little boy's life.
Wesley was critically ill in that moment. Will ended up leaving his job here in Portland because we just didn't know how much time we had with him.
We'll explore how the brains of psychopaths are wired differently.
So there's an intuition that once we understand how this circuitry works, we can use it to make, you know, predictions about how people will behave in the future.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. Congress is returning from its July recess with Republicans unclear if they have the support they need to pass their health care bill. The Senate bill could deeply impact Medicaid, a government health insurance program for the poor and disabled. And so later this week, families on Medicaid who received care at Boston Children's Hospital will meet with members of Congress. Among them will be the parents of 3-year-old Wesley Etheridge of York, Maine. Wesley was born with congenital heart disease and received a heart transplant at Children's. Joining us now are Wesley's parents, Alicia and Will. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Alicia and Will, could I have you first just start by telling me a little bit about your little boy, and how you essentially first found out about his condition?
So we knew that Wesley had congenital heart disease when I was about 20 weeks pregnant. So we were anticipating that he would need to have a heart surgery very soon after his birth. And my pregnancy was very closely monitored. So Wesley had multiple heart surgeries, one at 6 days old, one at 20 days old, almost 20 days old. And he was well for a while. And we were medically managing his heart disease. He had holes in his heart, and he also had a narrowed aortic arch, which had to be repaired. And then around his first birthday, he went in for a routine cardiac cath to take a look at his heart and how his heart was doing. And they saw that the pressures in his heart had become dangerously high, so he had an emergent surgery right after he had turned one and celebrated his first birthday in the hospital. And after that, he just never really was quite himself. Uh-huh. He had a lot of GI issues, vomiting, throwing up.
Oh, wow.
He was diagnosed as failure to thrive. He had some interventions around that, including a surgery where they placed a gastric tube in his belly. And he just never recovered after that surgery and, in fact, went into respiratory failure, landed in our local hospital. And at that point, it became clear to Will and myself that he needed to get back down to Boston.
Uh-oh, is that him coughing there? We hear him in the background. Are you all right,
Wesley?
Yeah. He's drinking some water.
So we ended up back down in Boston in February of 2015. So his team of surgeons and nurses and cardiologists met and determined that the best course of action was that Wesley needed to be listed for a heart transplant to be able to survive.
And Lisa, did you have a sense of this during the pregnancy? And you told me that this was around 20 weeks pregnant. You had a sense that things were not really going smoothly.
Yeah. Actually, we saw 13 weeks that something was not right. And I had a procedure called CVS, which is sort of like an earlier version of amnio. And did some testing.
Is Wesley your first child?
Yeah, he's our first child, and we're actually expecting our second in a couple of weeks. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
So, Alicia, you learned that Wesley needed a heart transplant. Can you tell us a little bit about what that day was like? I mean, do you remember what the day of his heart transplant surgery was like?
I remember when they came out and told us that, you know, Wesley's heart was not viable. And I remember having to make all of these, like, incredibly weighty decisions for a human being. When you're listed, you just don't know whether or not you're going to get the organ in time. Mm-hmm. Wesley was critically ill in that moment. Will ended up leaving his job here in Portland because we just didn't know how much time we had with him. It could, and if he was going to be able to live until, you know, the organ came.
Around when he was listed, he had a cardiac arrest. He was heavily sedated. So when he was listed for a transplant, he wasn't even awake and conscious. And we really didn't know, how he'd be when he came out of that.
So I hear him in the background, guys. So it sounds like hopefully he's doing much better now.
He's doing fantastic. It saved his life. He's completely transformed. It's just been so beautiful to see him come into his own, and he's just so much more confident. It's incredible.
It seems very comfortable chatting it up.
Yeah. Yeah, so when he's done here, he's going to go on a bike ride.
I see. So I hope you guys don't mind, but I want to talk a little bit about finances. I mean, Will, you had to quit your job in Portland. I imagine that this series of surgeries must have caused some financial hardships. Can you give me a sense? I mean, were you on Medicaid before any of this? Or when did you end up enrolling in Medicaid?
So I had an insurance through my job. I was the events and marketing manager for Portland.
For the city?
Yeah. Okay. And so when I left, the whole family was able to go on MaineCare, which is the state version of Medicaid. And Wes was on from the beginning.
Yeah, so in the state of Maine, when I was pregnant, I was uninsured. So when you're pregnant in Maine, you automatically qualify for Medicaid.
If you're
uninsured.
Got it. And you were never insured through Will's insurance. That was just
I was never insured through Will's insurance. So I was enrolled in MaineCare up until Wesley's birth, and then a few months after. And then Wesley automatically qualified for MaineCare when he was born. And then when Will left his job, our family status shifted, and it became based on our income.
Based on income. Can I ask, I guess I'm curious why you never were on Will's insurance. Was that just a matter of didn't make sense financially?
Expensive.
It was too expensive. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
And so at this point, are you all still relying on MaineCare, it sounds like?
To this point, yeah. Will's changed his career path after Wesley's heart transplant, and he's currently looking for jobs to become an English teacher.
Just hired recently.
Congratulations.
After Wesley's whole experience, I went back to school to get my teaching certification. I was really just blown away by the environment of being in the hospital. It was this whole incredible educational experience in a lot of ways, and it made me really want to become a teacher. And so I was recently hired to teach 8th grade.
So, Will, do you start in the fall then?
Yes.
All right. Good. Well, good luck. And then will you be, I guess, essentially you'll hopefully get insurance through that job?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
But we'll probably still pursue, Maine has a type of insurance called Katie Beckett, which is based on your medical necessity.
Is this part of Medicaid, Alicia?
Or? Correct. Okay. Yeah. It's part of MaineCare's program.
Got it. I see. Alicia, do you or Will mind sort of sharing it all with us, kind of the bills that we're talking about for not just the surgeries, but the actual eventual heart transplant? What financial amount are we talking about?
You know, we never saw the bills.
I see.
I'm sure we could have access to them if we wanted. I think that, do you recollect, Will, about the heart transplant, how much that was all in?
I don't know the breakdowns of it, but it's generally a heart transplant operation alone, can run to just ridiculous amounts.
Yeah. I just saw a note from our producer who found some data that suggested that the U.S. average for a heart transplant in 2011 was almost $1 million.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Wow.
And so having Medicaid allowed us to focus on Wesley. Okay, and focus on his care and be present for him. We didn't have to worry about the financial piece, which was tremendous, that we could really just put, and because we saw families go through not that, where they were worrying, or they were trying to push and advocate to get their child to move, to accelerate the healing process, one spouse couldn't be there. It's a tremendous hardship during a crisis moment, and we were really – I feel so fortunate that in this crisis moment in our family, we did not have to worry about the expenses and you know, Will and I could just be there to love on him and care for him. And, you know, and Will and I were able to stay healthy during that time, too, because we were covered, you know. And so it was about the whole family just, like, being well.
So Alicia, you all have pivoted now from this crisis to advocacy, right? You know, you'll be meeting with members of Congress on Wednesday and Thursday of this week. Is that right?
Yeah, on Thursday.
Okay, so this will be part of Children's Hospital Advocacy Day. You're going to be speaking up in support of Medicaid. I'm curious how and why you all decided to become involved in this effort.
Well, first and foremost, Boston Children's Hospital asked us to, and we are indebted to them forever, you know, that they literally saved our son's life. And one of the things that was really special when we first came in with Wesley was that there was another family in Maine who about a year or so previous had their son had a heart transplant, and they sort of gave us, you know, the 101 on how to, you know, survive this experience. And since we've gone to the hospital, we've connected with families who are also in that hard time of waiting for a heart for their child. And so there's been sort of this, you know, pay it forward mentality among the heart transplant families.
The community,
Exactly. So as much as we can, you know, do that on a large scale, we want to do that. So
do you have a sense of who you'll be meeting with while you're down in D.C., or have you decided what you'll be saying to people?
They're confirming for that for us tomorrow, but we would be seeing Senator Collins and Senator King, and then our congressional representatives, Shelley Pingree and Paula Quinn.
Have you thought about what you could say to convince them to see sort of things from your perspective?
All we want to say is really in his story, and we hope when people see how far he's come. We have a book of all his journey, and you can see how sick he is. And if you look at him now,
it, like a photo book.
Yeah, exactly.
That was something that the transplant team asked us to make for as a resource for other families, and it's just really powerful. It just, you know, I mean, visually seeing it can be as compelling as us talking about it, you know. And it's a great tool for him too. You know, he knows his story.
So you guys, I have to ask, I mean, about sort of the politics of this. You know, President Trump expects Congress to pass a bill to repeal and replace Obamacare, and the current Senate bill would dramatically cut the Medicaid expansion implemented during the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. If passed, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that by 2026, among people under the age of 65, enrollment in Medicaid would fall by 16%. It would also reduce Medicaid spending by $772 billion. And I know that this might sound cruel, but there are some folks who feel that essentially they do think that we need to sort of support the idea of rolling back Medicaid expansion, that it's really just unsustainable. It's simply too expensive to continue. That sentiment includes Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. In his state, the Affordable Care Act added about 400,000 people onto the Medicaid rolls. But Paul has said that neither the state nor the federal government really has enough money to continue to pay for them. And I'm curious, you know, how do you respond to that? Do you see his point? Do you have thoughts about where this money could come from?
Like I said, you know, when we were in Boston Children's Hospital, there was never this defeatist attitude. You know, they were coming up with, you know, ideas, you know, to keep Wesley alive that were, you know, extraordinary even to us. And we understand that's different than, you know, balancing, you know, a budget or whatever. But, you know, I think what makes America great is this ability to, you know, rally behind our people and believe in our future. And, you know, children are our future. And so we don't see this as an obstacle. And for every Rand Paul, there's other people, including elected officials, that say that we can do this. So, I mean, other people can talk much more eloquently in terms of the policy of it. But for us, it's clear that, you know, there's really nothing more important than taking care of each other, especially taking care of our sick children.
Yeah. And so when you do hear the sort of, I guess, these assessments, right? You know, the White House budget director has also said that these are not cuts. He says it's just a matter of slowing growth because we as a country, year after year, are spending more money on Medicaid, that it's unsustainable.
Yeah. So You know, I think a lot of that sort of very short-term thinking in a way, again, when I was saying that when Wesley was able to have access to Medicaid, it really is allowing for greater research, and we're learning more stuff, about congenital heart disease because of Wesley and because of children like him. That's going to benefit everyone.
Like scientific research, you're
saying. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That the more people that we treat, the better understanding that we have of treatment, and we can lower the cost of that as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd also say everyone is very, there's very much a sense that there's a lot of divisiveness and anger in this country right now. Mm-hmm. When we were going through Wesley's experience, it was the hardest, most stressful part of our time of our life. You know, Alicia is the love of my life, my soulmate, and we argued and fought more during that time just because we were so stressed out with stuff going on. And, so when I see so many people angry across the country, I can just know that the stress of, medical complications, of money complications, those can sort of, infect your life in a way and can lead to all sorts of anger. So I'm hopefully not making too big a jump that, the anger is related to all that, but I think it does play a part. And I think, this isn't just about, it's about making an investment in our future and mm-hmm. our health. So I think
sounds like you're saying the long-term research benefits kind of outweigh the short-term financial pressures.
Yeah, and the long-term benefits of a person being alive as not being alive, I think, are pretty stark.
Yeah. Well, Alicia and Will Etheridge, thank you so much for sharing your story with us all. I really appreciate it. Alicia and Will are the parents of Wesley Etheridge. They joined us today from Portland, Maine. Thanks again for speaking with Radio Boston.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And before we take a break, we wanted to give you an update on a story we reported here on Radio Boston. A few weeks ago, we brought you a special hour-long investigation into some of the lingering unanswered questions about Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He's the older brother of the two Boston Marathon bombers. Since we aired our story, we received new responses from the federal government. Joining me now in studio with an update is Radio Boston producer Jamie Bologna, who reported our story with Meghna Chakrabarty. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Asma.
So, Jamie, let's start with what exactly the new information is that Radio Boston received.
So, Asma, one of the big pieces of our Radio Boston investigation involved some curious findings in Tamerlan Tsarnaev's redacted immigration file, his A file.
That.
And so, yeah, when we first reported our story, we asked U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services about two copies of a 2003 medical examination form that was in his file.
Yep.
And so you can, I'm sure you've seen them, but listeners can go to our website and see those two pages. But the key thing to note about those forms are that they appear to have photographs of two different people on
them. I recall that. They looked quite different.
Yeah, exactly. Initially, USCIS wouldn't answer our questions about these two photos or really anything else on the record. Mm. But Asma, after we published our story, we followed up with them in their Washington office. And through a spokesperson, they decided to go on the record with some statements.
Okay.
So here's what the spokesperson told us about the medical forms. Quote, the errors in the photo were the result of scanning issues, end quote. And the spokesperson also told us that they're rescanning the pages to be included on the file online, and we'll include those scans on our website when they're available.
So, Jimmy, I just want to make sure I'm understanding that correctly. These two photos, listeners, if you go online, you'll see what the original photos look like. They do look really almost like two different people entirely, just the physical features.
Right.
So you're telling me that USCIS is saying that this was just a result of this, of how they were essentially scanned in.
Exactly.
Okay.
They are attributing it to scanning issues.
All right. And we'll see what
and they're calling it an error.
Got it. And we'll see what these new photos look like in time then.
Yes, we'll put them on our website when they're available. But what you can find right now on radioboston.org is our updated story with inline responses from USCIS on this topic, as well as a full document with all of their responses to our questions.
All right. Got that. Well, thanks for that, Jamie. And then the other thing that was interesting to me is that a big part of the investigation that Meghna and you did also involved a government program that can be used to put pressure on immigrants to become federal informants.
Right.
I know that you said that there was a response to this as well. What did you find out there?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the big, huge, looming, unanswered questions from our investigation is this one. Was Tamerlan Tsarnaev a federal informant? And that That was a big part of our story. And I should mention that in his immigration file, we found evidence that his citizenship application was routed through this program that you referenced. It's called CARP, or the Controlled Application Review and Resolution Process. So according to the American Civil Liberties Union, it's a program that has been used to recruit federal informants. And the ACLU says that, quote, CARP has effectively turned the immigration benefits adjudication process over to the FBI. So, again, after the publication of our story, USCIS responded to our questions, and they wouldn't directly address the question of Tamerlan's application and its processing through CARP. They did say that, quote, they don't comment on internal handling of specific immigration cases. But, Asma, they responded more broadly about CARP and strongly disagreed with the ACLU's assessment of the program, saying, quote, CARP provides USCIS personnel with a disciplined approach for identifying, recording, and adjudicating immigration benefit requests where a national security concern is identified.
Okay.
And the statement goes on to say, the FBI is an important partner in the security and background check process conducted on all individuals requesting an immigration benefit, and USCIS considers relevant information obtained through or provided by the FBI, but USCIS maintains the authority to adjudicate immigration benefit requests.
Mm.
So I know it's all an earful, but it's important to note that strong difference of opinion there between what the ACLU says CARP is and the way USCIS describes the CARP program.
Got it. Thanks for that, Jamie. And that'll be an interesting program, I think, to watch, you know, in time to come. I know I've seen quite a few news reports just about what essentially the CARP report does and some investigations into just trying to better understand it.
Yeah, we'll be following this on
Radio
Boston.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Again, that's Radio Boston producer Jamie Bologna. And listeners, you can see our updated story, Irreparable Damage, Unanswered Questions About Tamerlan Tsarnaev, which includes complete responses from USCIS, at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. This is Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. Today, Congressman Seth Moulton is in Ipswich to introduce the Chance in Tech Act. It's also known in long form as the Championing Apprenticeships for New Careers and Employees in Technology. It's a bill aimed at addressing a huge problem in the tech sector, the growing skills gap. Moulton wants to bring more people into the tech pipeline by expanding and investing in technology apprenticeship programs. We caught up with Congressman Moulton earlier today. He was on a cell phone in his car, so you might hear some background noise. I started by asking him what exactly the Chance in Tech Act would do.
Well, the Chance in Tech Act basically sets up this public-private entity to serve as a vehicle to get more apprenticeships in tech. This is something that we've seen across the world as a valuable way to train people for the IT jobs of the future. But we don't have good opportunities for apprenticeships here in America.
So, Congressman, is it going to be something that addresses, you know, high school grads or community college grads? Who are sort of eligible for these apprenticeships?
Well, it could be both. People who have gotten to had some community college or people who were straight out of high school. Of course, it depends on the qualifications necessary for the certain job or apprenticeship. But the point is that apprenticeships are a really great way to train workers for the new economy. And we don't have those opportunities, or at least we don't have enough of them in America today.
And you're talking about this as a public-private partnership. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that we've seen a financial commitment from companies, or do you have a sort of a commitment that they will hire X number of apprenticeships? Or apprentices, sorry.
That's exactly what we're trying to get, because there just isn't as much job training going on in corporate America as there once was. Big corporations, local companies used to take folks off the street, including many immigrants, for example, and teach them how to do the jobs in their factories. That's not happening enough in America today, and we want to jumpstart that because there are an awful lot of jobs that are unfilled.
Mm-hmm. And so at this point, is it going to be financial commitment and or a commitment to hire a certain number of apprentices?
Well, the specific policies will have to be developed. That's something that will take time. And we want the public sector and the private sector to work together to do that. Because ultimately, this should be something that not only benefits American workers, but benefits American companies, especially the startups, the new companies that are leading the way in technology. We want them to be leading the way in the global economy, and we want them to do it with American workers.
And do you already have any commitments or partnerships with companies in the Boston area?
We don't yet, but there are an awful lot of companies in the Boston area that are prime for this opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm going to EBSCO up in Ipswich, one of the biggest employers in my district, mm-hmm. today for the press conference. They're enthusiastic about this. They see the value of it. And we're bringing in a lot of companies to learn more about it. We're just getting this effort started. This is a new thing. This is a new innovation. So it'll take a little bit of time to get it. But this is the kind of leadership we need to embrace the economy of the future.
So, you know, one of the things that interested me about this bill is that it had such a wide, it seems like, bipartisan level of support at this early stage. And that's something you don't often see in politics. So I was impressed to see that. But then on the flip side, I will say in covering tech, one of the things I've noticed is that there is this sort of bias towards people with a college degree. And I've talked to, you know, folks who hire at tech companies, and whether or not a college degree is always needed, there just seems to be this preference for it. So I'm curious if that's something that you've already sort of heard or discussed any of the conversations you've been having.
Look, I've seen that a lot. I see that preference. And look, I'm a big supporter of everybody in America having the opportunity to go to college, but that doesn't mean that everybody wants to go to college or that's the best thing for everybody. Sometimes when we need IT help around the office, you know, people say, well, I've got a high school kid who knows this better than anyone. So we've got to be open to those opportunities and recognize that there are many different ways that Americans can contribute to the new economy, and they don't all require a college degree.
Mm-hmm. So since I have you on the line, can I pivot just for a minute and talk to you a little bit about a few other political stories that have been bubbling this week?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So President Trump tweeted this morning that he cannot imagine that Congress would dare to leave Washington without a beautiful new health care bill, fully approved and ready to go. Are you expecting that to happen?
Well, I certainly hope that we leave Washington without stripping health care away from millions of Americans, because that's what the Republicans are trying to do.
Uh-huh. And you've come out strongly against the GOP health care plans. But I'm curious what you think Democrats need to do to make their opposition sort of, you know, as effective as possible to this, particularly the Senate bill.
Well, look, we got to explain this to the American people. We just got to explain what this GOP health care bill will do. It's really not even a health care bill. How do you call a bill that takes health care away from millions of hardworking Americans a health care bill? It's really just a tax cut bill for the ultra rich. And mm-hmm. the facts speak for themselves, but we've got to tell that story. We've got to explain to people what's at stake here. We've got to explain to what it means to their families if the Republicans succeed in passing this horrible, horrible bill.
And Congressman, you did multiple tours in Iraq, so I just want to ask you briefly about the latest news out of Mosul. This weekend, Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi went to Mosul to congratulate the Iraqi army for winning the city back from ISIS. What is your reaction to the idea that the Iraqi forces have reclaimed this city?
Well, first of all, it's congratulations. This is a great achievement, and it's something that the Iraqis did with our support, but leading the effort on their own. But my question is the same question I always ask, which is, what comes next? Frankly, it doesn't surprise me that they were able to defeat ISIS in Mosul. It was only a matter of time. But we've defeated terrorist organizations like this in the past, and yet they keep coming back because we don't put the proper governance and diplomatic efforts into ensuring the peace. So what comes the day after Mosul falls still remains the key question, and I have yet to hear a good answer.
I know that you were quite critical of the Obama administration's Iraq policy, or lack of an Iraq policy. Do you feel that you've gotten any greater clarity from the Trump administration about what's next?
Absolutely none. And to be clear, my view on the Obama administration policy is that they were actually quite effective at defeating ISIS. The Obama administration killed a lot more ISIS fighters than the Trump administration has to date. But the question I asked again was, what mm-hmm. comes after we defeat ISIS on the battlefield? And the Trump administration has yet to even address that question, let alone provide a good answer.
So, Congressman, one sort of final parting question, and that is that, you know, I was a political reporter in a former life when we first met.
Yes,
when I actually covered your run the first time for Congress. And I'm curious because I know that you've been very vocal about House Democratic leadership, specifically Nancy Pelosi. But there are reports that early on she helped you and that you wrote a letter thanking her for that help. And I'm curious to hear from you what has changed, if anything.
Well, first of all, there's nothing changed in the sense that I'm happy to write thank you notes for people who do good things. I mean, I wrote a thank you note to Paul Ryan last week. That doesn't mean that I'm going to agree with him. But the reality is that we need new leadership in the party. We can't keep losing election after election. And our party leaders have to be accountable for that. So I have great respect for Nancy Pelosi and all the things that she has done. She's the first woman to become Speaker of the House. But I think we all know that it's time for new leadership today, that we've got to have a plan that's forward-thinking, that brings all Americans into the new economy, that says that we're not just going to oppose Trump, we're going to provide some real alternatives. We're going to provide a new vision for the country. That's what Democrats need today. We've got to start winning again because so much is at stake. And this GOP healthcare bill is the latest example of what happens when Democrats aren't winning elections and don't have the reins of power in Washington.
Do you have an idea of how to do that, how to start winning again?
Well, I think part of that equation has to be new leadership. I think part of that equation has to be coming to terms, looking ourselves in the mirror, and recognizing where we failed in the past and what we need to change to start winning in the future.
That was Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents the Massachusetts 6th Congressional District. I spoke to him earlier today from the North Shore. Plans for reconstructing Boston's Huntington Theater over the next 3 years are receiving widespread support. The renovation is not just a physical transformation. As WBUR's Maria Garcia reports, it's also a philosophical change focused on two big questions: what a theater should be and who does it serve.
Our offices are across the street in the basement, so we're always happy to be like, hooray, we're out of doors.
On a sunny, breezy day, the Huntington's marketing director, Temple Gill, stands outside the theater. She lifts her eyebrows, widens her eyes, and smiles as she explains how the theater will soon change.
So this, if you can imagine it, will be a beautiful, beautiful glass wall.
She's pointing at what's currently a ramp leading to the theater's doors. Gill and others at the theater feared the Huntington would lose its home after Boston University announced in 2015 that it was selling the building and ending its longtime relationship with the theater.
And it's easy now to say that, oh, we knew everything was going to be fine, but we really didn't. It was a nerve-wracking time. But thankfully, the mayor and his team, to whom we're so grateful, stepped in.
Mayor Marty Walsh worked with the new owners of the building, QMG Huntington, on a plan that would keep the theater in its place.
That whole sign will come down now.
Yeah.
The theater, built in 1925 as America's first civic playhouse, is stately. The hefty brown brick and white pillars on the front of the building make it look a bit like a fortress.
It's I think, a gorgeous building. It has a lot of history.
Gorgeous, but not necessarily the most inviting place. Theater goers want a gathering place, not a fortress, says Michael Masso, the Huntington's managing director.
We really do think of it as a living room for the neighborhood.
Huntington Avenue, which has also been called Boston's Avenue of the Arts, has been in the midst of a physical and cultural transformation in recent years. There are new buildings at Northeastern University, the Museum of Fine Arts Wing of the Americas expansion, and now the Huntington's development proposal. Again, Temple Gill.
We feel that we are a cultural anchor on the Avenue of the Arts.
The Huntington will raise up to $70 million to restore the current theater, while the developer will add a modern lobby and 14,000 square feet of space, including a cafe, expanding into the building next door. On top of that, high-rise apartments for a total cost of more than $200 million.
That will make it not a palace of performance, but more of a community center, and I think that's where we need to be.
Julie Henricus is the executive director of Stage Source, an organization that advocates for and works with theater groups.
We're gathering people in a room you know, for a play or for a dance performance or for music is actually a pretty political act. I mean, it's, you know, let's all be together and experience this together, and that builds empathy.
Henricus hopes that the Huntington expansion will also benefit smaller and fringe theater companies without a physical home, who rely on people's living rooms or makeshift performance spaces. The lack of space restricts who's able to make art, she says.
I do think it's a place of privilege, where you may know somebody who has a room that you can use for free, or you own a home that's got a big enough living room that you can have a rehearsal there.
The Huntington already provides spaces at a subsidized cost to smaller theater groups at their Calderwood Pavilion in the South End. But the ambitious new plans for the original Huntington Theater will take these efforts to a new level, says Managing Director Michael Masso.
This is a program that is going to change the cultural life of Boston in the way that very few opportunities can do.
The Boston Planning and Development Agency, which must review and approve the building proposal, will hold community hearings in the next few weeks to gauge support for the plan.
And that story comes from WBUR artery reporter Maria Garcia. You can see the Huntington's redesign plans on the artery section of WBUR.org. Stay with us. Coming up, we dive into the brains of psychopaths and discover some surprising information. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. If you watch a lot of Hollywood slasher films, you're probably familiar with the stereotypical image of a psychopath, the serial killer who shows no emotion and behaves without any regard for anyone else. But it turns out that may not be the whole story. There's more that we can learn from the brains of psychopaths. With me in the studio right now is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog for our regular Monday Common Health segment. Carrie, thanks for jumping into the studio.
You're welcome, Asma. And yeah, the accepted wisdom is that the main issue with psychopaths is that they're lacking in empathy, that that's how they can be so cruel and sadistic. But there's some really interesting new research out suggesting that psychopaths tend to have another key deficit, that their brains are wired in a way that makes them really bad at making good decisions, at sort of projecting what the results of their actions will be. And it's a paper just out in the journal Neuron.
Got it. And Carrie, you brought a guest with you into the studio today to give us a sense of the science behind this all. He's the senior author of that paper you just mentioned, Joshua Buchholz. He's a psychology professor at Harvard whose research focuses on the brain science of self-control. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me here.
So Josh, if I can call you Josh.
Please do.
I wanted to start off by saying that, you know, you looked at the brains of psychopaths, but I want to ask a really elementary question. And that is that I think I understand what it means to be a psychopath when we use that word pejoratively, but I don't know that I understand what or who a psychopath is scientifically. Can you explain that to me?
Sure. It's a great question, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about what psychopathy is and isn't. The first thing that I want to clarify is that being a psychopath is not the same thing as being psychotic. So people who have psychosis, as you might have in schizophrenia, they lose contact with reality. They have delusions and hallucinations. That's psychosis, or a person who has psychosis is psychotic. Different than psychopathy. Okay. Psychopathy is a personality disorder that has really two domains of symptoms. The first of those is an emotional or interpersonal set of symptoms. Psychopaths are glib and superficial. They're egocentric and grandiose. They lack remorse and guilt and empathy. And the other domain has to do with their behavior. They have very high levels of impulsive antisocial behavior. They commit a lot of crime. They have poor behavioral controls. They move around from place to place. They tend to be somewhat parasitic.
Is there a scientific actual sort of measurement of this in terms of identifying who would be a psychopath?
There are several. The most commonly used is called the Psychopathy Checklist Revised, or PCLR.
Okay.
And it's a semi-structured clinical interview that we do often in forensic settings like prisons.
So, Josh, I'm curious in the general population, what percentage of us have psychopathy?
So the prevalence of psychopathy in the general population is thought to be around 1%, maybe a little bit less.
Okay. And in the prison's population?
Anywhere between 25 and 35%.
Oh, wow.
That's big.
So let's pivot back to your study for a minute. And can you tell me what you actually found out based on looking at the brains of psychopaths?
Sure. So I'll just say that research on psychopathy has largely focused on the emotional and interpersonal dimension of psychopaths. And it's contributed somewhat to the sense that psychopaths are these cold-blooded, almost alien super predators. Mm-hmm. And there's this sense that psychopaths do all these bad things that they do because they can't feel the same things as you and I. Mm-hmm. And we took a slightly different tack. We were more interested in the decisions that that these individuals make, because regardless of what they feel or don't feel, they make a lot of bad decisions. And so we gave them a decision-making task while in the MRI scanner.
Okay.
These were incarcerated offenders who had to drive the scanner to the prisons.
Okay.
And we found that in the first instance, a part of the brain that represents the value of different actions, called the ventral striatum, is hyperactive when these individuals make what we call intertemporal choices or delayed discounting tasks.
Can you give me an example of one of those?
Sure. It's like, imagine on every single trial, this task, the subjects are choosing between a sooner but smaller and a larger but later reward. So you can have $5 now or $6 in 6 weeks, right? Or $6 now or $20 in 12 weeks.
So it's kind of like the famous marshmallow test, right? You can get one thing now or two things later or something like that.
That's right. It is looking at the ability or the willingness to delay gratification. And so we mapped out some of the circuitry involved in representing the value of rewards when people make those kind of decisions. And we found that psychopaths have overactivity in this part of the brain called the ventral striatum. And we also found that that's due to the fact that another region of the brain in the prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. this is called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, is not able to talk to the ventral striatum in a way that happens in people who are not psychopaths. And so this interaction, this connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and the ventral striatum appears to be broken in a way that doesn't allow the ventromedial prefrontal cortex to do its typical job of regulating the activity of this region.
And Josh, you also found that these measures of brain activity correlated pretty well with how many crimes each of the guys you scanned had been convicted of, right?
That's exactly right. So the degree of dysfunction in this circuit that regulates how we make decisions was associated with the number of criminal convictions each offender had experienced.
Was it just men that you ended up surveying?
We only looked at men in this sample. That's right.
Okay.
You know, this raises the question of whether someday you could use some brain scan, some measures of connectivity to try to help predict whether somebody is likely to commit a crime or not, right?
So yeah, that's absolutely true, and it's an understandable instinct.
That seems so scary, though.
Well,
it's Minority Report.
But the good news is that that's actually much harder than it would seem to be. So there's an intuition that once we understand how this circuitry works, we can use it to make predictions about how people will behave in the future. Our research was very much focused on understanding the mechanisms that lead to bad decisions in psychopaths. But it's not a small thing to take that information and use it to make predictions. That actually turns out to be, for a number of very boring and some interesting reasons, incredibly complicated and not likely to be a thing that we'll be able to do well in the near future.
Got it.
So that's probably just as well, right?
I mean, it does seem like it. You know, to me, I will say, though, one of the things that when I initially sort of I read Carrie's story about your research that concerned me was this idea of, I guess I understand when we talk about psychopaths not being able to empathize. That's sort of a thing that I understand then why they make certain choices. I think that the idea of looking at maybe impulse control felt a little scary to me because I can think of lots of folks, including myself at times, who don't have like the best impulse control if we're talking about like eating a marshmallow or delaying eating a marshmallow. You know?
No, I understand what you're saying, and take some comfort from the fact that, one, you don't appear to be a psychopath.
I hope not, yes. Thank you.
And two, that something like psychopathy, you get by having deficits in a range of different psychological processes.
I see.
So just having this decision-making deficit doesn't make you a psychopath. Likewise, just having the empathy deficit doesn't make an individual a psychopath.
Uh-huh.
There are disorders that are characterized by similar deficits in empathy and the ability to read other people's mental states, that don't result in high levels of criminal or antisocial behavior. So any one of these deficits on their own doesn't make the disorder. It's the collection of them in one person that produces this outcome.
Although one part that I found really interesting was that this work seemed to be bringing two streams together, in that, so there's the problem with empathy, there's the problem with projecting what's going to happen in the future, and both of those seem to come from a brain that's bad at making mental simulations, right?
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And this focus on simulations turns out to be potentially a very fruitful avenue of both further research and potentially interventions in psychopathy. So what do we mean by simulations? When I am thinking about what you are feeling right now, I am engaging in a simulation of your mental state. I'm trying to model your mental state to figure out what is going on, you know, in the black box of your mind.
Okay.
Likewise, I can simulate about the future. I can figure, you know, what's going to happen if I do this action versus this action. I have to engage in what's called prospective simulation in order to figure out what is the best thing for me to do now if I want this thing in the future. And simulations of both kinds are thought to be driven in part by activity in this part of the brain called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So you have this one part of the brain, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, that's responsible for, you know, simulations of whatever kind that seems to be dysfunctional in psychopathy. And so you can imagine that you have this singular neurobiological deficit that produces lots of different pathological outcomes because, interfering with the ability to perform these kinds of simulations, this core component of human experience, has ramifications in lots of different domains of human endeavor.
Fascinating.
And it also, to me, the most fascinating question it raises is, so does this mean that we should view psychopaths differently if work like Josh Buchholz's shows that they have broken brain circuits?
Meaning, does it, you think, require more empathy from those of us who are not psychopaths to understand certain behavior decisions?
Well, I always struggle with questions like this because the brain is responsible for all behavior, right? Every feeling that we have, every action that we take, every bloom of joy, right? Every bite of envy, every experience that we have, every choice that we make arises inexorably from patterned coordination of brain firing, right? So all behavior originates in the brain.
Mm.
That's an inescapable fact of neuroscience. And so given that, the fact that psychopaths' bad behavior arises from brain dysfunction, it couldn't be otherwise. What you do with that information from a moral and philosophical perspective is in an important sense above my pay grade.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to go out for a couple of beers and speculate wildly about the implications for these things. But, you know, you don't ask a quantum physicist, as he's at the particle accelerator, what does this mean in terms of the existence of God, right? And you don't do the same thing with an astrophysicist when he's at his telescope. Have you found existence of God yet?
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, the fact that we can identify some of the neurobiological mechanisms for behavior in humans doesn't speak at all
about excusing it or not excusing it.
That's right, because it's not fundamentally a scientific question. It's a philosophical and a moral question. Which, again, I'm happy to play armchair philosopher. But there's nothing specifically about my expertise as a neuroscientist or these data that say anything meaningful at all about it.
But you could say that the data could help us understand evil better, maybe.
But evil, again, is not a scientific concept, right? It's not something that is amenable to scientific investigation.
Do you think, though, that there's some defense at all legally when people then can make the argument that my brain made me do this?
One's brain makes one do everything and anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can flip the script for a second, what difference would it make to you? At the end of the day, we incarcerate way too many people, and we incarcerate them under conditions that are barbaric, appalling, and ultimately counterproductive. So what does this bit of information have to, how does it speak to that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think maybe on a more positive direction, we could ask you, can this work, which could help us understand psychopathy better, can it lead to better interventions with these guys?
Ultimately, down the line, what we're focused on is building a strong empirical foundation for devising new treatments that can help people with some of these decision-making deficits make better choices. And that's in their interest and in our interest. But one study can never, almost never, provide a firm foundation for a new intervention.
Yeah. But fascinating nonetheless. So.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. That's Josh Buchholz, an associate professor of psychology at Harvard who studies the brain science of self-control. Thanks again.
It was a pleasure.
And Carrie Goldberg, she's the host of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to her post about this new research on psychopaths at our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks so much.
Welcome, Asma.
All right, folks, that is all for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston.